This is KCR 88.9 FM in Irvine. Coming up, Subversity. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Today, we're going to bring you the program we meant to bring you last week, an interview with Bill Ayers, who is the author of Fugitive Days, a book about his days as a Weather Underground person. The Weather Underground blew up buildings and or tried to, and also protested the war in Vietnam. When he got out, the charges had all been dropped against him because of government malfeasance. We dedicate this show to the memory of Peter Beale, whose daughter had died in South Africa, but despite that, she was a Newport Beach Fulbright scholar in South Africa, but despite that, Peter Beale worked for reconciliation in South Africa and was portrayed, his family was portrayed in the film Long Night's Journey into Day that was shown 2 years ago at the Newport Beach Film Festival, and he appeared on this show 2 years ago this past week. The Newport Beach Film Festival also is showing right now. Tonight there'll be John Waters showing Polyester. Next few days there'll be other films for another week or so. And you can look at the reviews, for instance, at ocweekly.com, www.ocweekly.com. I have a review of at least two of the films from the Philippines and a mention of a South Korean film on that website. This is Dan Zhang. Now let's go to our interview with Billy Ayers, who wrote a book called Fugitive Days from Beacon Press. Okay, it's taping now, and then I can cue it up. Okay. Cool. I just want to turn off the buttons here. Let me get to it. Bill Ayers, who's written a book about his Fugitive Days. Yeah, that's the name of his book, from Beacon Press. Do you feel that after 9/11, that are there things you regret writing in this book, in this memoir?
I don't think there's anything I regret writing. I was writing a memoir of events that took place over 30 years ago. And what I take the requirement of memoir to be is to try to recapture the sights and sounds and smells and feel of a particular world, a particular moment, and then to set a person loose in that moment and see what it felt like to be there then. As I reread the book, I felt that in the main it succeeded as memoir. It was not a manifesto, it was not a defense, it was not a judgment, but rather it was an attempt to take readers with me into an extreme moment in American history when I was a young person, and extreme decisions were being made, and I wanted the reader to feel like what it was like to be there then, to feel, you know, to smell the kind of tear gas in your own nose and to feel the wind whipping your own hair. That was my attempt. And no, I don't regret writing it. I think that the timing of its release with the events of September 2001 was certainly propitious in some ways, and I think that what happened is that it had one virtue, which is that it forced some very tough questions onto the table for me and for other people, and I think tough questions are good for us.
How about the criticism of that you didn't, that you were, I mean, there's some people argue that you were just blowing up things without any reason.
Well, you know, people argue a lot of things, but what I tried to do, again, was to show to the world that I tried to take you into was a world from 1965 to 1975. Those are the years of the American War in Vietnam. In those years, the American government brought a terrorist war against the Vietnamese people. 3 million people were killed. Those of us who began kind of waking up and seeing what was happening and opposing the war, did by 1970 move in a very, in a way that was extreme and in some cases off the tracks. But let me give you a little bit of the chronology. In 1965, at the University of Michigan, reasons, really two big reasons. But I mean, a smaller reason was that we organized and demonstrated and knocked on doors and tried to convince people that the war was immoral, illegal, and should be ended. But the biggest reasons that the sentiment of the country changed were two. In the first place, the black civil rights movement was setting the moral agenda as well as the tactical agenda for the country. And so issues of social justice and fairness and equity were in the air. And so when the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee said in the mid-60s, no black American should go 10,000 miles away to fight for a freedom that he doesn't enjoy in Mississippi, that shook the country up. When a young Muhammad Ali said, I won't serve in the white man's army to dominate people of color. And in fact, he said, no Viet Cong ever called me nigger. When he said that, the whole country really started to tremble. And when Martin Luther King said, risking his great prestige and the great support he had from liberals and from the labor community and so on, when he said the war is immoral and the war should end, the handwriting was on the wall. The other thing that happened between 1965 and 1968 is that massive numbers of young people began returning from the war, working class kids, mostly kids of color, and they described what they saw there, and they were horrified about what they'd been asked to participate in. And when they lined up on the steps of the Capitol and ripped the medals off their chests and threw them back at the war makers, once again, the country was shook up to its core. So by 1968, we all thought the war would end. I remember when Lyndon Johnson stepped down from his attempt to be reelected and said, I'm going to try to concentrate instead on ending this war. We rallied at the University of Michigan, and the president of the university said to us, congratulations, you've won a great victory. Now the war will end. And he believed it, and we believed it, in late March 1968. A week later, King was killed, and America went up in flames. A year later, we knew that the war not only wouldn't end, but that it would escalate. And at that point, hard decisions were being made. Some people joined the Democratic Party and tried to build a peace movement within the party. Some people organized in working class communities. Some people moved to communes. I and a small group of other people began to build a clandestine capacity to take the war to the war makers and to resist what we thought was a coming repression. We saw it everywhere. Were we wrong? I don't know if we were wrong. We were deciding in a very complicated set of circumstances. You're right. People have criticized me for not being sorry about it. And I would say this. Every day that the war went on, 2,000 innocent people were killed. Every day for 7 years that war dragged on, 2,000 more people were killed. Trying to stand up against that terror took a certain amount of determination. And I'm not sorry about anything that I participated to try to end that war or against that government that was waging that war. I have a lot of regrets for how people were treated, for how how I thought about myself, for the arrogance of my own dogmatism and so on. But I have no regrets for anything I did against the government then.
Okay. How about your days in Ann Arbor, Michigan? Were you? I went to school like about 6 years after you in Ann Arbor, and I remember running into people that were in the White Panther Party. Were you part of that?
No, I wasn't. Although I had many, many good friends who were there. In fact, I ran into John Sinclair a month ago, who's living in New Orleans, doing very much what he always did. But the White Panther Party was a group of cultural revolutionaries, mainly the Motor City Five and the Iggy Pop and a whole bunch of people were around that. They were artists and anarchists and dope smokers and really a good group of people. They thought we were way too earnest. John used to criticize me for being way, way too earnest, and he's probably right.
You mean too serious?
Yeah, earnest. I mean, serious, not just serious, but serious to a fault. Serious to the point that you couldn't see irony or humor or contradiction in matters. You saw things way too one-dimensionally.
So why was there what led to the use of bombs, I guess? I can understand going underground and fighting the government, but what do you think was your thinking that was necessary to go put bombs in public buildings and stuff?
Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, you would know if you, I mean, you, any of your listeners who want to read the book, you'll see kind of where the logic took us, but, or took me.
Right.
But I would say this, that I make a great distinction, even today, between what I would call terrorism and what I would call political violence and what I would call the responsibility of citizens. In my view, terrorism is always wrong. It's always wrong. It's never defensible, even if the cause is just. What we saw on September 11th was a pure act of terrorism in an unjust cause. But even if the cause were just, terrorism is always wrong. Why? Because terrorism targets innocents, civilians, random people just walking down the street for violence, and it does it in a way that is designed to sow fear into people. Now, defining it that way, you can recognize that terrorism isn't just the property of an individual, it's not just the property of a sect or an organization, but states and governments can participate in terrorism, and in fact, almost all of them have. Go back in history. The Roman legions were terrorists. The Ottoman Turks were terrorists. The Incas were terrorists. And so were the Spanish, who conquered the Incas. So you have a long history. And in the United States history, we have several instances of terrorism. One of the more recent ones being Vietnam. That was a war of terror waged against civilians, intentionally designed to hurt people, innocent people, in order to dissuade them from going in a certain political direction. That's terrorism. So I'm opposed to it. But I'm not always opposed to the use of violence to oppose violence. I think sometimes you have to respond to an attack by fighting back. And so, for example, if you're walking down the street innocently and two people jump upon you, or you're walking down the street with a friend and they jump on her, don't you have a responsibility to fight back? Most of us would say we do.
But that's, some would say that's just self-defense. But you're saying it is self-defense, what you did.
In that case, it's self-defense. What about this? What about if you're living in a city, say New York, and people are aiming missiles at you? Do you have a responsibility to resist that, to fight back? Of course you do. What if it happens to be not New York City, but Hanoi, Vietnam? What if a great power is dropping bombs on the civilian population of Hanoi? Do you have a responsibility to fight back? I think you do. And if you do, then what's the responsibility of someone who is a citizen of the country that's visiting that violence upon Hanoi? I think the responsibility is to try to stop the airplanes from taking off. And essentially, that's what I did. I tried to stop the airplanes from taking off.
And you also targeted buildings, but not people, right?
Never people. Never civilians, never innocent people, never anybody. Not only did we design what we did to cause no bodily harm to anyone, we never harmed anyone, never killed anyone, never even hurt anyone. So this idea that somehow we were terrorists, when in fact, all around us, the terror war waged on and on and on. So I find it quite hypocritical when I get letters from people saying, aren't you ashamed of yourself for being a terrorist? And I typically respond by trying to explain in a very dispassionate way that I never was a terrorist, that I flirted with the idea once upon a time but never carried off. On the other hand, we all know for sure that the president of the New School for Social Research, Senator Kerry from Nebraska, did participate in terrorism. He's a nice guy. He's a good guy. I know him, and I like him in many ways. But if somebody's writing me a letter asking me to account for my behavior, I want them to call Senator Kerry and ask him to account for his behavior, because he did behave as a terrorist, and I never did.
But of course, one of your best friends died in a townhouse, right, in East Village. I'm sorry.
My mother and two of my best friends. Yes. Oh.
And that was a total accident.
That was an accident, but and they blew themselves up. But in my book,
I speculate about whether that accident might have been caused by one of them. So I'm not certain what happened. Nobody is. I wasn't there. But I think that at that point, the people that I was close to, including those three people, had gone in many ways off the deep end, and we were considering the possibility of answering official government terror with a terror of our own, but we never pulled it off.
Who are the ideological kind of the leaders of, who are the people that you admired at the time? Was it Mao? Was it Ho Chi Minh? Or who?
I admire a lot of people, but the people that I look to as kind of mentors and people who I think taught me a lot about the world and about social justice, I would start right here at home. I would say Ella Baker, Septima Khan, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Bob Moses. These are people who influenced me tremendously, as well as artists and writers like James Baldwin, Sonia Sanchez. These were people who influenced me a lot. Miles Horton, great educator. So that was those were some of my influences. I knew a few of those people, but they all influenced me. Internationally, certainly, the struggle of the Cuban people led by Fidel Castro and Che Guevara influenced me. The struggle of the Vietnamese people was decisive for me. Why? Because it's the place where the United States, my government, my country, was involved in a very bad business. And since it was my country, I looked at it very closely. And what I saw was terrible. And I knew that I had to oppose it. I was a kid who grew up in tremendous privilege. I grew up in tremendous, almost suffocating, almost blinding privilege. And I made a decision to try to see the world as it really was. Seeing the world as it really is puts you into a zone of discomfort. But you then have to decide, is my morality just for my little town here, for just my little tribe, or does it apply to all people? And I think the moral response during the Vietnam War, which most Americans eventually came to, was to oppose that war.
Your father was head of a utility company.
That's right.
In Chicago.
And chairman of Commonwealth Bank. 30 years, that's right.
Did he finally come around to your point of view?
Oh, I don't think so. but he's still living, and we're very good friends. But he's quite old now and retired.
So, were you able to? I mean, you said you lived a privileged life. Were you able to use any of the money from your family to fund your underground life?
No, because I was by that time cut off from my family. I mean, I had cut myself off. One of the themes of the book really is the theme of exile. From a very early age, I recognized that if I was going to understand any other human beings, I was going to have to exile myself from the padded, privileged suburbs of the 1950s. And I did. I joined the Merchant Marines. I moved away to Ann Arbor from the suburbs of Chicago. But I discovered something very important, and I think it's a lesson for all of us, and that is that in order to become one with humanity, you must feel not at home in your home. In other words, you must feel a bit of estrangement from your own local situation in order to see the world larger. And I think that that's something that we should all recognize today. If we want to know the world we live in, we have to open our eyes. That means, for example, after September 11th, I asked one of my classes if everyone would draw a freehand sketch of Central Asia. And they couldn't, and I couldn't. And the fact is, we, in many ways, as Americans, don't know where in the world we are. We are 5% of the world's population, but we think of ourselves as way more important than we are, partly because we consume 50% of the world's stuff, and that gives us a distorted view. That privilege gives us a distorted view of our own power and our own goodness. I argue that exile is a good thing for those of us who are living privileged lives. In order to connect with humanity, you have to leave America, metaphorically, mentally, imaginatively, at the very least.
Some of the people you you hung out with underground had gone to Central America or gone to other places, right?
Yes.
And so they saw America in different eyes after being able to.
That's true. They saw the bad side of it. They saw the ways in which America is not a benign and beneficent presence in everybody's lives. In many ways, America is a malignant presence in people's lives. And when we see the events at September 11th, and people say, great, powerful politicians say, well, they hate us because of our democracy. On the contrary, everyone I know from around the world admires the democratic institutions and the prosperity. What they don't admire is our willingness to enter their lives in ways that disrupt them, that are cruel, that are oppressive, that are exploitative. And it's our responsibility as citizens to see that, to understand that, and to object to that. So again, if there's a lesson in the book, it's the value of exile as a perspective. It's also the responsibility to act on what you know about your country, your government, what it does in your name. And then there's a third lesson, and that's the lesson to beware of your own dogma. Beware of your own self-righteousness. It's never enough to know that the other guy is, that the government, say, is making mistakes or is wrong in certain ways. It's also important to examine your own assumptions, your own dogma.
Do you wish you had done more of that?
Do I wish I'd done more of that?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I wish I'd been smarter, wiser, more compassionate, more capable, more humane, more centered, more in harmony with myself. Sure, all that. So when people, if you wonder, do I have regrets? Many, many, many regrets. But is one of those regrets that I took extreme measures against the United States at a time of tremendous crisis? No, it is not. That I don't regret that. It would be like saying, let's take another American historical moment. During slavery, some people, not the majority, but some people in the North helped slaves to escape. The majority of the people opposed slavery by the 1850s, but only a few were willing to act on that opposition. When the United States government passed the Fugitive Slave Law, the Underground Railroad largely collapsed. Why? Because most people in their privilege weren't willing to risk their freedom or their lives on behalf of black slaves in the South. A few forged ahead, John Brown, John Brown's family, those types of people. But the fact is that a violent, horrible institution was living right at the heart of American society, and only a few people opposed it. 30 years after the fact, if you were to say to Owen Brown, for example, do you regret being, taking up arms against the government? I think he would be foolish to say, I regret it. He may regret a lot of things, but to regret fighting against slavery would be foolish to take that back. Well, I don't think that what we were fighting against was at that quite that level of catastrophe, but it was a human catastrophe, and our government was dead wrong, and what we did to oppose it was, in the same sense that they were wrong, it was right.
I remember the 60s as a time of a lot of political debate, long meetings discussing different, strategies, different positions, different party lines. Was Life Underground a series of debates on political positions, or was it more mundane?
Well, we were all extremely political people, and in that sense, we loved meetings, and we loved debate, and we loved discussion, and we loved finding new readings and chewing on them forever. On the other hand, I think that we had developed, by the late 60s, myself and a few of my close associates, a style of debate and discussion that was counterproductive. We were mostly into shouting one another down and posing rather than thinking. And I think that that ended very soon after we went underground. So while we were still incurably political, in the best sense of the word, I don't think that we were as intolerant, as self-righteous, as dogmatic in our political exchange.
Do you think
to return to some of our roots, which had to do with being honest about your willingness to engage in political discussion and political debate, but also being willing to let practice be the judge of who had the right position, rather than who shouted the loudest, you know, and that kind of thing.
Did being a man have a lot to do with the shouting?
I think so. I think the style of debate was macho. I think it was male-dominated. I think it was certainly a male form of exchange, you know, standing up and kind of shaking your fist and making your intellectual points and picking them off your notes. Yeah, I think it was a male way of being. And I think that when we were underground, first of all, women, you know, ascended in terms of the leadership. And also, we developed a style that was much more borrowed from the women's movement, and that is consensus rather than, you know, shouting debates, a sense of being willing to sit in a circle and talk things through and listen, a willingness to see complicated issues as complicated and nuanced rather than one-sided. Yeah, I think we borrowed a lot and learned a lot from the women's movement.
So more focus on the process.
Well, I don't know about more focus, but certainly there was a sense that the process mattered. It didn't necessarily matter. It wasn't necessarily superior to the conclusion, but it certainly mattered in coming to some of the right conclusions. We pulled way back from the style and stance of kind of macho bully boy tactics into a much more consensus-driven kind of approach.
In the book, you talk about noticing all the women a lot more than the men, I guess.
I talk about what?
Noticing more of the women.
Noticing them in what sense?
Finding them more interesting.
Yeah. True.
But did you have any close male friends?
Yeah, Jeff Jones is my best friend, and I write about Jeff, and Terry Robbins was a good friend, and he's one of the people who died in the townhouse, and I write about Terry. You know, I think that that I had many, many good friends. My brother was and is a very good friend of mine. But I still found then, and you know, that women, Bernadine in particular, in many ways, added a dimension of thoughtfulness and seriousness that was lacking in some of my relationships with men at that time.
Right. And how about in terms of subsequently, I mean now, these days, do you think people seeing you as a role model, some of your students seeing you as a role model and they want to emulate you?
Well, I don't know. You'd have to ask them. I think that I'm a teacher, and I've been a teacher for 30 years, and in my view, the best way to be a teacher is to be a student of your students, and so my teaching tends very much to be organized in a kind of a seminar-type way, and my students teach me as much as I teach them. I try very hard to stay alive as a thinking person so that I can create a kind of an environment where the possibility of asking important questions and pursuing matters deeply is a possibility. You know, but I don't think of myself as a role model particularly. I think of myself as just one other struggling person trying to make sense of the world and trying to participate.
But do you think since 9/11 that students feel that they need to, it's harder to fight against this system?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I could generalize like that. I think that there's many, many signs that that students, young people, continue to ask the important questions about what is moral, what is right, what is fair, what is just. And sometimes they come together, as in some of the anti-globalization stuff, and they try to act on those, on the answers that they're getting to those questions. I think young people care about, typically my students, they care about issues like racial justice, like economic justice, like world justice. I think they worry about questions of fairness and equity. I think they want to live lives that don't make a mockery of their values. And I think they're struggling to find ways to do that. Now, if you just listen to the media, the mainstream for-profit media, if you just watch CNN, you might, I think, mistakenly believe that the country is, unanimous in this kind of suffocating, narrow view of what September 11th represents and what it means. And therefore, you would kind of conclude, I think, in despair, that everyone is a born-again patriot who wants the United States to bomb the rest of the world into oblivion. The fact is that I've been all over the country since September 11th, and I've talked to lots and lots of people, many who don't agree with me, many who, who did not agree with the book and did not agree with my portrayals. But, you know, I don't find that unanimity out in the world, and I doubt that you do. When I was in Ann Arbor, when I was in San Francisco, Seattle, L.A., New Orleans, I found a wide range of opinions about where we are and where we're going, and I didn't find unanimity. So I think it's silly to believe that, to despair about where we are in this country. I think there's a lot of energy that wants to question authority, that wants to wonder about the direction we're taking, that still cares about fairness and equity.
I just went to an anarchist conference a few weeks ago in San Francisco, and there were like hundreds of people at the conference and the book fair. And you, in the book, you mentioned that your friends, some of your friends, were anarchists at the time. Was it a different? Do you think anarchism has changed? Or what do you think?
I'm just not even sure, because I considered myself partly an anarchist then, and I consider myself partly an anarchist now. I mean, I'm as much an anarchist as I am a Marxist, which is to say, you know, I find a lot of the ideas in anarchism, you know, appealing. When I refer to the anarchists in the 60s, partly I'm talking about a kind of stance in the world, not talking about a political ideology.
A cultural
stance, that's right.
Yeah.
And so, but a lot of the people that I hung out with, including myself, felt that most of the rules that were written didn't apply to me, and therefore should apply to others. I mean, a great example, when I was 18, being the marijuana rules. I mean, none of us saw reasons for why these things were against the law. And I still don't. I still don't get it. I mean, we create felons by having these kind of archaic Puritan drug laws that make no sense whatsoever in any logical way. So in that sense, I still feel like kind of an anarchist. I don't feel like the rules apply. If they don't apply, I don't feel like you should follow them. On the other hand, I think that as a political ideology, it's certainly got its limits. But I think to the extent that it expresses a mood among young people that wants to say, we want to engage in a kind of direct democracy. We want to participate in the decisions that affect our lives. We want freedom, not a set of constraints and rules and big brothers. I think all that's to the good.
There seems to be a split now in the anarchist movement, at least between the green anarchists and the red anarchists.
And what are the explain to me?
Well, the red anarchists are the people that believe in the kind of syndicalists, I guess. They believe in, like it's more the IWW type of union, whereas the green anarchists are more into ecology movement stuff.
Right. Well, I think we would be foolish if we split on issues like that. What we ought to do, I think, is link up and say, if you're a militant environmentalist, you can still participate in that movement, still be in solidarity with a militant kind of one union, one great union kind of movement. We don't have to be opposed to each other. Our oppositions should be, we should fight for ways to find unity, not ways to find what makes us distinct from everybody else on the left. I mean, that's my view.
So you would work with, say, the RCP. They showed up at the anarchist conference.
Yeah,
coming out.
I suppose I would. Although if they were complete lunatics and trying to take things over, I would urge them not to try to take things over and not to be so dogmatic. But, I mean, like, take the Earth Firsters. I mean,
right.
If they're an example of green anarchists, I think they should be willing, and I could be both supportive of them, and I think they should be willing to be supportive of me. I don't think that we have to split just because their field of work is ecological issues.
Right. Because basically it's a common enemy, right?
That's what I think. And I think that one of the things you'll notice is that in America there is no left. There are many leftists and there are many progressive projects all over the country. I mean millions and millions of people. But there's no left in the sense that there's no organized group, as there is on the right, of people with money, leadership, strategy, tactics, and a willingness to work in the political arena to accomplish their goals. We don't have a left.
How about
we have
the green
progressive impulses. The only way that we're going to build a left is if those progressive impulses can find points of unity in which we can come together to operate on the political level in a way that we never have in recent memory.
The Green Party.
Yes.
Do they constitute the left in America?
Well, they constitute, you know, they constitute the possibility of a left, but they're not a unifying force. I mean, certainly I voted for Nader, and I thought that was an important thing to do. But that was a kind of a political campaign. It's not in itself a force in American politics in the same way that, say, the right is. The right has think tanks, radio shows, talk shows, newspapers, editorial pages, a whole intellectual infrastructure, as well as generous funding so they can get the stuff done that they want to get done, and acknowledged leaders. And the bizarre thing is that the leaders are now in charge of the White House, the Senate, the Congress, and the Supreme Court. I mean, the reason I say it's bizarre is that 30 years ago, nobody could have imagined that the hard right would have won this many victories, but they have. So we should learn a lesson from that, and we should find our points of unity, find our places we can come together to operate politically. It doesn't mean, for example, that you or the Earth First people can't do their work independently of that, but some of their work has to be towards building that unity.
But do you mean just electoral politics?
I don't just mean electoral politics. I mean building the intellectual infrastructure that makes electoral politics happen. I mean building the kind of economic power that makes that impact felt. You know, electoral politics are a piece of it, but if it's only electoral politics, then it doesn't have the depth and staying power of a real left that really participates in the political life of the country.
I know people that today they call themselves revolutionaries, and they put down, you know, electoral politics, put down reformism or reforms. How do you react to that?
Well, you know, when I was underground, I voted every election that came along under several different names. But the reason I did is because I think it's a false dichotomy.
Right.
The mistake comes if you believe that electoral politics is in itself democracy. That's a mistake. But if you believe that you're doing a more direct democracy, a more participatory democracy, you're organizing in real, deep, political arenas, that's good. But that shouldn't prevent you from voting or from, electing candidates or parsing issues, at the ballot box. I think it's important that you do that. And the reason I do is because even though in the United States elections have been reduced to a kind of a sham in some cases, Florida being the most obvious example of a stolen election, but also they've been elevated in the popular mind to say this equals democracy. No, elections don't equal democracy. In fact, we have a weak democracy. We lack the soul of democracy in this country, and therefore elections are kind of an empty exercise. But if we were to lose the right to vote, we would notice it, and so we should not lose it. We should exercise it, and we should breathe real life into it, and we should work locally to build the kind of political power so that an election is simply an expression of that. There are many great examples from the 60s. I mean, you know, the fact is that Lyndon Johnson had to do what he did in terms of civil rights legislation. He had to, because masses of people were in motion around that issue. But it's a good thing he was there to do it, too. And he didn't call in the stormtroopers and shoot everybody, right?
Right.
And these things work together.
Recently, there was on campus here at UCI, Ted Lowy, who is a professor of politics of government at Cornell, and he's a critic of the two-party system, and he's basically supports third parties, and he's saying that there's a duopoly that actually keeps out third parties.
Sure.
They have no chance, and that it's basically stacked against the third-party system.
So is he arguing that we should build third parties?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's no doubt that the Republicans and the Democrats are two sides of the same coin. I don't think there's any question about that. On the other hand, I don't know enough, and I don't think anybody does, to know what the correct strategy is to break that monopoly. A third party might be the way, but third parties in this country have often, gone up in smoke. Another possibility is that activists build a base within one of the parties so that they can accomplish their goals through the big party, through the machinery of the party. We've seen both things attempted over the last 100 years. Both have been limited. But what I would say is, regardless of what strategy you take in terms of party building or participation in electoral politics, the fact is that if you're not building a base on the ground, in the factories, in the shops, in the communities, in the universities, in the intellectual infrastructure, if you're not building that, then you're wasting your energy with either electoral politics or party politics. Let's build that. And if the party's a vehicle to build that, good. But if it's not, build that and participate in electoral politics, you know, as it comes to you.
On that point, when you were underground, did you feel like isolated from the masses or from people that you thought were your supporters?
On the contrary, I felt completely connected. I didn't feel isolated at all. I felt that that we were living our lives quite openly. I mean, we didn't live under our own names, but I was working, you know, ordinary jobs that working people worked. I had many, many friends who didn't know my name, but they knew, I mean, they knew me under a false name, but they still knew the real me. We had lots of connections with the above ground movement. We participated in the debates of the above ground movement through the underground newspapers, through the mass media, through organizations, and so we felt very much in touch, not out of touch at all.
These days, do you think that do you see other people doing that now? I mean, going kind of underground, but
I mean, there are some people, I suppose, around the environmental stuff in
right.
front. But I don't think, I think that what we need now more than ever is a kind of an engaged, sustained political engagement by activists of the left at all kinds of levels. But I don't think it's particularly appropriate to build the whole underground infrastructure now, because there's not a mass movement that could support such a thing. Our job is to build, our job, whatever tactics we use, our job is to educate many, many more people in a strong analysis of what this country is up to mobilize many, many more people for social justice projects, for activists, for actions that are about fairness and peace. And if we could do that, then we'll see where it takes us. But at this point, to build an underground almost seems to me like it would be posing, you know? You'd have the form of being a militant without the reality. And the reality is that you always measure your tactics by how much it organizes and educates other people. And I don't think we're at a stage where that's what's needed or that's a priority.
Isn't there always, people who think that they can go underground and become a revolutionary these days, isn't that kind of romanticizing
that's
the past?
Yeah, it's kind of posing and romancing rather than doing the hard work. I mean, in my view, the great strength of the 60s was precisely that lots and lots of people like myself, who never would have thought of myself this way, suddenly thought of myself as an organizer and an educator. And that's what my job was. And eventually, I went underground. I would say I was driven underground, in a sense, by the events of the day. But my main work for all that time was trying to knock on doors, reach out to others, explain to people, persuade people, and in the process learn myself about the limits of protest, about the limits of, about the obligations of citizenship and the limits of resistance. But I think those are things that are learned in the struggle.
You know, while you were underground, you also raised a couple of children. Did the 60s actually, I mean, the 60s is, people talk about different ways of child rearing, differences in sexuality, differences in relationships. How did that period affect, I know that it was like a group kind of raising of children, right?
Well, except that by the time we had our children, we've always tried to live, in a larger community, in a more communal and collective way. But certainly, when our kids came along, I was working in a shipyard and we were living in a little apartment, and no, we raised our kids, I don't know if it was traditional or non-traditional, certainly they knew that they were growing up in a political household. I mean, you know, one of my sons talked about fairness. I mean, he didn't always get it right, but he would say that's not fair, whether he was referring to a racist stereotype in the newspaper or the invasion of El Salvador. But he had some sense that we were a family that was living happily in resistance to the mainstream culture. I mean, I'm grateful that all three kids are now grown up and are just terrific people. They have great attitudes, great values, great, you know, kind of generous spirits. One of them is very political. One of them is an artist. I don't think that they're gonna, you know, they're not clones of us by any means.
They didn't turn right wing.
I'm sorry?
they didn't turn right wing.
No, I don't think, you know, I think that while there's some things that normal, no, I don't think so. I think that kids, our kids were deeply loved. They grew up in a very stable and happy kind of environment. I think that they saw themselves as important in their own worlds. They pursued their own interests and got a lot of support from us. I think that it would be unusual for kids like that to turn to the right because the right writ large represents a kind of stinginess of spirit, a kind of selfishness, a kind of me first mentality, and they don't have any of that. They have as I say, one isn't particularly political, he's more of an artist, but at the same time, he has a sense of being one among many in this human family. He doesn't have a sense of himself as entitled or privileged beyond others.
But, you know, look at the case of Dave Horowitz, right? I mean, he's one of the critics of your book, and he used to be a leftist.
Well,
right.
Exactly. His parents were Stalinists, and when he ran away from Stalinism, he went all the way over to Reaganism and beyond. So David Horowitz is the kind of poster child of the apostates. But the fact is that Horowitz, I mean, if you read Horowitz or take him the least bit seriously, he's a clown. And his ideas are half-formed. He speaks in a kind of a half-language of slogans and received beliefs. He's kind of a dope. But yeah, he was once the editor of Ramparts. His parents were CP members. And now he's seen the light. One of the things about people who see the light, I've been very taken by this book that this guy wrote who was the poster child of the right. What was his name?
Brock or something?
I'm sorry, yeah.
Brock.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things about being an apostate, being a changer, is that you can change, flip back and forth depending on which way the wind is blowing. I fully expect Horowitz to be raising the red flag, you know, 15 years from now when the left is in ascendancy.
But the weather people were named after, you know, after, wasn't that where the wind is blowing?
Yeah, exactly. Well, what we said was you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. You can figure it out for yourself. And the wind is not blowing. We argued then that the wind was blowing towards national liberation and people breaking the stranglehold of imperialism. That certainly happened, but now we're in a very different world, and it's a world where, you know, the struggle between globalism and the people of the world is still quite intense, but at the same time, there's a struggle over various religious fundamentalisms, jihad being, you know, the most visible, but the religious fundamentalism of the, Christians and of the Jews is equally troubling and equally arid.
And during the period you were underground, I guess, there was, you formed a group called the Prairie Fire?
When we were underground, we wrote a book called Prairie Fire.
Right. And I remember getting it was this yellow and red,
yeah.
And I have copies, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And,
great, we'll compare notes. Where are you calling me from?
From Irvine, Orange County.
Oh, you're in Orange County,
but that's the hotbed of Reaganism, I guess.
I know it is.
There's a book from a Harvard sociologist whom I interviewed a few months ago. She basically said these coffee clutches in Orange County led to Reagan being president.
So
it's kind of the new right. But now Orange County is totally changed.
Yeah.
It's huge diversity. In population, Latinos, a huge number, Asians in this area too, and so it's totally no longer lily white. But I was going to ask you about was that in retrospect, do you see it as very kind of rhetorical, kind of that pamphlet?
No, I actually think that I'll say a couple of things. I think that Prairie Fire as a little booklet is a pretty sound analysis of what's gone on and what is going. even 30 years later, I think the politics stand up remarkably well. What doesn't stand up is the kind of arrogance and the kind of self-righteousness that kind of powered along next to those politics. I don't feel proud of that. But I do think that the politics, if you read Prairie Fire today, it will say in very strong language that the people of the world are being exploited and oppressed and you know, militarized by the great imperialist powers led by the United States. That is the situation today, in my view. It's a situation we should all be horrified at and we should all oppose.
I guess you're a professor now at University of Illinois.
I'm a professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago.
Do you have students who don't see the Vietnam War the same way you do?
Oh, I think most young students today don't even know what the Vietnam War was. we live in the United States of amnesia, and people forget very quickly. So I think that students today are not as up to date as they are not as up to kind of standard as they ought to be. In terms of history, in terms of economic realities, in terms of understanding the world. Yeah, I think we're all suffering from that.
Yeah, one thing that impressed me about your book was that you quoted a lot from what Ho Chi Minh wrote, and a lot of people, especially out here now, we are actually near Little Saigon out here, and, it's very anti-Ho, of course.
Yeah,
of course. Although I've actually beginning to meet a lot more Vietnamese who are actually becoming radicals.
I don't doubt it. It doesn't surprise me at all.
And also, I've been trying to research the Vietnamese who were here before 75, who were sent by the government of South Vietnam to get educated in the U.S., who actually turned against the war.
Yeah,
so there's actually, at that time, they're almost all forgotten.
Yeah.
Because the history is rewritten so that it's almost like every Vietnamese in the U.S. is anti-communist or pro-U.S., and that wasn't true. So how do you kind of uncover the history? I mean, do you have trouble trying to relate a kind of a progressive critique of the war and of U.S. foreign policy to your students?
You mean today?
Today.
No, I don't have. I kind of know what I think, and I'm very open about what I think, and nobody here is surprised by what I think. I think that most of my students. I mean, I think that certainly people were horrified at what happened September 11th, but the range of opinions about what it meant was vast in the beginning, and it remains vast. This attempt to organize it as one simple single note. America's the greatest country in the world, and that we should all wave our flags, and we should fight terrorism, which means drill oil in Alaska, and give up our civil rights, and so on and so on. I don't think people buy into that. Not my students, not in the main. Now, that doesn't mean that I agree with every student all the time. We talk about issues of the day, and we talk openly about things. But I don't find it difficult to express myself or to listen to other opinions, and I tell you, the rule of thumb in my seminars is very simple. Everyone should be allowed to speak with the possibility of being heard, and everyone should listen with the possibility of being changed, including me. And so we have strong discussions, we debate lots of issues, and we learn from each other.
That was Bill Ayers, who wrote Fugitive Days. We'll put the entire interview on the web at the Subversity site, kuci.org/TTSANG. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity. Come-